What the hell is a hop?
Mario says.
I think it's like a dance.
Niall says, frowning.
A kind of dance from days of yore?
Or a dance for one-legged people?
Jeff surmises.
It's a Halloween disco for the second years from the two schools,
Dennis says.
My brother told me about it.
A disco? Skippy says.
They do it every year. Everyone dresses up.
Holy shit,
Mario says.
This is excellent,
says Niall.
A ghoul for every boy,
Jeff says in his zombie voice. Up and down the corridor, boys are excitably making the same discovery, much to the chagrin of the automator, who snaps at them to quit stalling and get to class, then realizes it's lunchtime.
I'd better buy some condoms,
Mario says.
This hop will be a beaver shoot.
It's going to be spooktacular,
Jeff says in the voice.
Will you stop that?
Says Dennis.
Juster!
Someone's calling Skippy. It's Howard the Coward, hailing him from across the hall. What can he want?
I wonder how many condoms I will need.
Mario ponders as Skippy trudges away.
Probably I should get a couple of boxes to be on the safe side.
Make no bones about it.
God damn it, Jeff!
We're going to have a whale of a time.
Leaving the automator's office yesterday evening, Howard had little intention of following through on his promise to talk to Daniel Juster. The acting principal loved to issue orders, but that was usually as far as his interest extended, meaning that if Howard could just keep out of his way for the next couple of days, there was a good chance he'd forget their entire conversation. This seemed to Howard, who didn't see why he should be lumbered with extra work, to be the best course of action. Until this morning, when a very strange thing had happened. He'd stayed up late the night before to finish Goodbye to All That, and in his second year class today, he decided to begin with a brief excerpt from the book before wrapping up the First World War and moving on to the Easter Rising. Graves's account bore little resemblance to the Barren History textbook. It fluoresced with imagery. The skeletons in the craters in No Man's Land, picked clean by the rats. A wood full of German corpses, whose overcoats Graves brings back to his trench for blankets. The officers versus sergeants cricket game, with a rafter for a bat, a rag tied with string for a ball, and as a wicket, a parrot's cage, with the clean, dry corpse of a parrot inside. Every page contained some night-black gem. After reading aloud for a couple of minutes, Howard became aware of an unusual silence. Instantly, he was on his guard. A silenced classroom, in his experience, meant one of two things. Either everyone had fallen asleep, or they had planned some sort of a trap and were waiting for him to stumble into it. When he scanned the desks, though, the boys appeared fully conscious, and there was no hint of impending attack. It dawned on him that this must be what is known as an attentive silence. Attempting to conceal his surprise, fearful of breaking the spell, he continued reading. The book held their attention right up to the end. When the bell went, Howard had the giddying sensation of actually having imparted knowledge. It was an unexpectedly replete and heartening sort of feeling, so much so that when he spies Juster now, examining a poster for the Halloween hop, instead of turning in the other direction, he decides to call him over. He watches the boy shuffle across the hall and readies an avuncular smile.
I just wanted a quick chat,
he reassures him.
You don't need to look so freaked out.
As he speaks the words, it strikes Howard that the automator made a shrewd move, picking him to talk to the youngster. Certainly he's going to be more in his wavelength than some septuagenarian priest.
I hear you tossed your cookies in French class yesterday,
he says. I what?
You threw up? You got sick.
The ends of the boy's mouth turned down.
I just wanted to see if you were feeling better.
Yes, sir.
Yes, you're feeling better?
Yes, sir.
You and Father Green have buried the hatchet?
Juster nods.
He can be a tough old buzzard, but I wouldn't take anything he says to heart.
The boy makes no response. Frankly, he does not seem to Howard all that appreciative of his interest. But kids often hide their vulnerability behind this kind of attitude, he reminds himself. You have to give them space. Let them come to you.
And how are things generally? How are you doing?
Fine. Juster suddenly looks wary, as if Howard is trying to catch him out somehow.
Your schoolwork going okay? Not finding it too hard this year?
The boy shakes his head.
Your family's doing well? Your parents?
He nods. Howard searches around for another question.
How about swimming? I hear that's going great.
The boy nods again, pale brows furrowed apprehensively, like he's playing chess with death for his soul. Howard begins to get exasperated. This is like pulling hen's teeth. Still, he ought to put in another minute, just in case Greg does ask about it.
You know, I was talking to your swimming coach yesterday,
he says.
He told me some really...
But the words die away on his lips, as he is caught in a smile as sudden and bright and paralyzing as a prison searchlight. Miss McIntyre has appeared beside them. The smile is, evidently, for him. He hears himself speak to her, without knowing what he says. God, those eyes! Just looking into them is like being kissed, or no, like being magicked off to another world, where it's just the two of them alone, the rest of the universe mere tinseled scenery, orbiting in a slow waltz around them. Sir? Howard is returned to reality by a small voice tugging at him. He turns and stares at the owner as though he's never seen him before in his life.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Miss McIntyre brings a hand to her mouth.
I didn't realize you boys were in the middle of something.
No, it's fine.
He assures her hastily, then returns to address Juster.
Daniel, you'd better head off to your next class.
It's lunchtime.
Well, to your lunch then. We can finish this later in the week.
Right. Juster says dubiously.
Good man,
Howard says.
Okay, well, off you go, so.
Juster obligingly stumps off down the corridor.
We'll catch up later in the week,
Howard calls after him.
And have a good talk, okay?
He turns back to bask in the lovely light of Aurelie McIntyre.
Sorry,
she repeats gaily.
I didn't see him there or I wouldn't have interrupted you.
No, don't worry. It was nothing,
Howard assures her.
He had a little run-in with Jerome Green yesterday. Greg asked me to have a word with him, make sure he was all right.
I think he's in my geography class,
she comments, adding,
he's so small.
Usually he'd be sent to the guidance counselor, but Greg thought he'd prefer to speak to someone younger.
Howard elaborates.
You know, that he could relate to.
She absorbs this thoughtfully, or mock thoughtfully. Many of her gestures, he's noticed, have this disconcerting hint of unseriousness, of artificiality, as though she has lifted them for her own amusement from some antiquated sitcom. How to get the real Aurelie.
Oh, here, I meant to say to you.
He chucks her arm.
I took your advice and got that Robert Graves book. I was reading it to my class just now. You were right. They loved it.
I told you.
She smiles.
Gives the war a whole new dimension, you know? Hearing from someone right there in the thick of it. They really connected with it.
Maybe it reminds them of school,
she suggests.
Didn't someone describe the trenches as 99% boredom and 1% terror?
I don't know about boredom. God, the chaos of it. The brutality. And it's so vivid. I'd definitely be interested in reading his poetry. If only to see how he can go from describing, you know, people getting their guts blown out, to writing about love.
Maybe it's not that much of a leap.
You don't think?
Have you ever actually been in love?
She says teasingly.
Yes, of course.
Howard professes, flustered.
I just meant, in terms of writing, that stylistically it must be quite a jump from one to the other.
Mm-hmm.
She is doing the thing with her tongue, examining her upper lip with the very tip.
Listen, we sort of got off on the wrong foot the other day.
Did we?
Well, I mean...
He is dimly conscious of boys streaming by them on either side.
You know, you told me you weren't going to do a certain thing with me.
I told you I wasn't going to sleep with you.
Yes, that's right.
Feeling himself flushing deeply.
Well, I just wanted... I hoped I hadn't given the impression. I mean, I just wanted to tell you that I wasn't, you know, I wasn't intending to, do that with you either.
She takes a moment to digest this, then says...
That's all you could come up with? After 2 whole days?
Yes.
He says reluctantly.
Now I'm definitely not going to sleep with you.
She says with a laugh, and turns on her heel.
Look!
He puts in desperately.
When you say that, what is it that you mean?
See you later, Howard.
She calls over her shoulder.
Wait!
But the enchantment is over. As he hurries after her, he is aware once more of existing in a world of objects, of obstacles, coming between...
I do beg your pardon, Howard. I didn't see you.
Howard, winded, can only gasp.
Ah, Robert Graves.
Jim Slattery lifts the book from the floor, where it has fallen.
Are you reading this to the boys?
Hopelessly, Howard stares after her receding form, which even seen from behind, seems to mock him.
Remarkably versatile writer, Graves.
Slattery continues obliviously.
One doesn't come across his sort too often these days. Poetry, novels, classical mythology. I wonder, have you ever looked at his White Goddess? Barmy sort of a thing, but quite intriguing.
Howard knows there is no escape now. For 5 years he sat in a classroom and listened to these rambles. Once Jim Slattery starts on a topic that interests him, only an act of God can divert him.
Delves into various pre-Christian societies, Europe, Africa, Asia, and keeps finding this same figure, this white goddess with long, fair hair, blue eyes, and a blood-red mouth. Right back to the Babylonians, it goes. His theory is that poetry, as we know it, grew out of this goddess worship. All poetry, or rather, all true poetry tells the same story. A fertility myth, I suppose you'd call it.
Blue eyes. A blood-red mouth.
Battle between the poet, who represents the coming spring, and, as it were, his supernatural double, or negative self, who represents the past, winter, darkness, stasis, so forth, for the love of this white goddess.
Definitely not going to sleep with you.
Ended up in Mallorca, of all places. Graves, that is. Moved there with a woman, a poet, Dea. Went there ourselves, actually, a couple of years ago, my wife and I. Delightful place once you get away from the resorts. Astonishing scenery and the seafood. I remember my wife turning to me one night. She was having the shrimp.
Howard nods vacantly. In the distance, he imagines he can see her white scarf whisk into the thicket of the annex, like the tip of a fox's tail. As soon as Skippy's out of sight, he starts to run. He keeps running until he finds himself in his room, his head full of flying sparks, almost too thick to see through. Talk to you? What does he want to talk to you about? Oh, fuck. Panic crackles down his nerves to spark painfully in his fingertips. Thoughts crash into each other like bumper cars. And the worst thing about it is, he doesn't know why. He doesn't know what's pushing against the door of his brain. He doesn't know why his heart's beating so fast. He doesn't know why it's so important he doesn't talk to Howard the Coward. And now he doesn't know why he's standing on a chair and hauling his bag from the wardrobe. tugging open drawers and flinging the contents over his shoulder onto the bed. Underwear, socks, t-shirts, jumpers, runners. And then something flickers past the window.